For a religious leader to question a person's faith is disgraceful. I am proud to be a Christian, and as president, I will not allow Christianity to be consistently attacked and weakened, unlike what is happening now with our current president. No leader, especially a religious leader, should have the right to question another man's religion or faith. They, the Mexican government, are using the Pope as a pawn. This angry exchange would not seem to leave much scope for portraying Trump as the Catholic favorite in the 2016 race, but that underestimates the possibilities of outright fraud. In 2016, a previously unknown website designed to look like that of a local TV station, WTOE 5 News, began circulating a false story that the Pope had endorsed Donald Trump. That first release generated about 100,000 engagements that month. WTOE 5 News vanished from the internet soon afterward. But in late September, as if carefully timed to enhance the Podesta leaks, another previously unknown site, Ending the Fed, reposted the papal endorsement story. This time, the fake story generated more than 1 million Facebook engagements, winning the honor as the single most circulated fake story of the entire election. Trump commands the news cycle like no other American leader since Ronald Reagan, yet he is no political giant. He and his campaign team of C-class talents stumbled from mistake to mistake, and they continue to stumble. It would not have taken a miracle to bar him from the presidency. It took a negative miracle to tumble him into it. Once in office, it was not his own cunning that enabled him to defy long-established standards of decent behavior. It was the complicity of his allies among the conservative and Republican political, media, and financial elite. The election of 2016 popularized the political science concept of negative partisanship. The concept's authors, Alan Abramowitz and Stephen Webster, observed that while many Americans do not identify as Republican or Democrat, virtually all Americans dislike one of those parties much more than they dislike the other. Trump cannily exploited negative partisanship to consolidate political support he could never have attracted for his own agenda or his own merits. Trump campaigned as a nationalist on the slogan, "Make America Great Again." But he never spoke to or for the whole nation. The nation was too big, and he was too small. He excelled instead at discerning the grievances and angers that set American apart from American, and especially the grievances and angers of those who, like himself, felt entitled to dominate the apex of American society and now found themselves somehow occupying a place beneath their expectations. Despite his inherited wealth and self-made global fame, the presidential Donald Trump could never overcome the haunting suspicion that people laughed at him. At the time Trump clinched the New Hampshire primary in 2016, the Washington Post counted 103 instances since 1987 when Trump publicly referenced that sound of laughter. Many Americans hear that same laughter. Trump mobilized them behind a politician who would silence the laughter if he did nothing else. At least he isn't politically correct. He speaks his mind. I'm tired of these special snowflakes. This was the last-ditch language of the Trump supporters, never mind that many of them were the most special snowflakes of them all. Trump's counselor, Kellyanne Conway, once bitterly complained of all the silence and sighs that greeted her inquiries about the admission of her children to the poshest private schools of Washington, D.C. The United States was living through an epical shift of economic power and cultural status, and Trump's supporters perceived themselves as the targets and losers in that shift. It's wrong to imagine those supporters as all displaced factory workers, all struggling coal miners. Many people, solidly middle class or even rather affluent, also felt that their world was turning upside down in the 21st century. Many traditional Republicans, too, uncomfortable as they might be with Trump's loudmouth tweets, wondered if Trump were at least the right man for the times. a contributor to a pro-Trump website lamented, "Conservatives have won elections for decades, yet despair as the country moves further and further left, and every generation seems more insane than the last. Actually doing anything to confront the power of Hollywood, the mass media, or leftist corporations remains unthinkable, as doing so would clash with principles such as freedom of speech and limited government. Meanwhile, the left presses on, destroying every last vestige of racism, sexism, or homophobia." This is perhaps why Donald Trump has struck a chord with so many Republicans. Whatever his faults, at least he fights. Trump, for example, is not going to sit there and let the wife of a serial rapist tell him that he's the commanding general in a war on women. For 75 years, conservatives have stuck to their principles as they have done nothing to challenge the power of those seeking to destroy all they hold dear. The results are clear, and more are waking up to the true nature of the modern left. That was phrased more pungently than most, but even non-Trumpist conservatives pulsed to such emotions. Peter Augustin Lawler is a distinguished academic who served on President Bush's Council on Bioethics. Thoroughly Trump-skeptical, he nonetheless offered National Review's readers some cautious praise for Trump's brutishness. "What's wrong with gentlemen in public life? That's Trump's real question. They're losers. McCain and Romney, nice guys who looked good in going down in flames. McCain, in particular, is a loser Southern stoic, and no gentleman such as Jeb low-energy Bush could be any match for Hillary Clinton or ISIS or Silicon Valley oligarchs or emasculating political correctness." Even Trump's most ardent critics on the political right wondered whether he was not merely symptomatic of a culture in decay and possibly might even, in his rough way, offer some kind of antidote. Thus, Harvey Mansfield, the sole conservative in Harvard's government department, wrote in the Wall Street Journal of July 30, 2016, "We are caught between distaste for a man who is not a gentleman and dislike of the political correctness that he so energetically attacks, yet whose effect he illustrates." Trump's critics loathed the president as a bully, but bullies pick on the weak. Trump's supporters saw their cultural enemies as much stronger than themselves. A revealing example made news in mid-summer 2017. On June 29th, President Trump tweeted a pair of harshly personal attacks on the MSNBC morning host Mika Brzezinski. "I heard poorly rated At Morning Joe speaks badly of me. Don't watch anymore. Then how come low IQ crazy Mika, along with Psycho Joe, came to Mar-a-Lago 3 nights in a row around New Year's Eve and insisted on joining me? She was bleeding badly from a facelift. I said no." The president's spokesperson, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, insisted at her press briefing later that day that it was Trump, not Brzezinski, who had been the victim of bullying. "I don't think that the president has ever been someone who gets attacked and doesn't push back. There have been outrageous personal attacks not just on him, but on everyone around him. People on that show have personally attacked me many times. This is a president who fights fire with fire and certainly will not be allowed to be bullied by liberal media or the liberal elites within the media or Hollywood or anywhere else." And although a morning show host has no army, no intelligence services, no power to issue orders and pardons, Huckabee Sanders' version of the case nonetheless resonated with many millions of conservative Americans. Whatever else Trump may fail to do, staff a government, enact a program, safeguard U.S. classified secrets, relieve disasters on Puerto Rico, there is one thing at which he never fails: provoking outrage among the people whom Trump supporters regard as over-entitled and under-deserving. The New York Theater and Arts and Croissants crowd, as Rush Limbaugh calls them. But don't belittle theater. Trump is the producer, writer, and star of an extravaganza performance of the Theater of Resentment. He summons all those who share that resentment to buy a ticket and enjoy the show. The United States has seen many such characters before, of course. The founding generation warned against them. They warned, too, of the desire in foreign powers to gain an improper ascendant in our councils. How could they better gratify this than by raising a creature of their own to the chief magistracy of the Union? For more than two centuries, through more than 50 presidential elections, those warnings were heeded. This time, not. One could say the system failed, but systems are made of people with names, motives, and agency. It was not some big sputtering turbine, some grinding mass of gears and levers that empowered and enabled Donald Trump. It was people. People with American flag pins affixed to their lapels. People who put their hands over their hearts during the Pledge of Allegiance. People who swear to uphold the Constitution. People who salute the military on Veterans Day and mourn the brave fallen on Memorial Day. People whose throats catch and whose eyes glisten when they declare their love of country and their willingness to sacrifice their all to defend its freedoms. Those people have explanations for their actions, as we all do. The people's business must be done. You don't have to like the president to work with him for the public benefit. You can support Donald Trump when he's right and still oppose him when he is wrong. Just shut out the noise and get to work. Sounds pragmatic. There will be payoffs for those who do business in this way, not only in policy, but also in the form of more personal rewards. The opportunity of an all-Republican government may not last long, and the shrewd will seize the moment. More than in most administrations, the Trump White House has made celebrities of its leading personalities, and celebrity is a highly liquid currency. But the payoffs exact a price, and that price is exacted by the megaton from American institutions and to American world leadership. For the remainder of the Trump presidency, American allies will have to make their plans on the assumption of American untrustworthiness. That kind of planning can be habit-forming. For the remainder of the Trump presidency, military and intelligence leaders will work around a president who makes impulsive decisions, issues reckless statements, and cannot keep secrets. Those who serve in government will perceive that public integrity has gone out of style, polluted by a president who resents and resists the enforcement of rules. The one-third of America that identifies as conservative will be isolated even more profoundly within an information ghetto of deception and incitement. As in his business career, so in government, Donald Trump grabs the benefits for himself and a few associates while offloading the costs onto those foolish enough to trust him, and anyone else who cannot wriggle away. So let us start by looking at Trump's associates. Without them, Donald Trump would have remained what he was before 2015, a television personality, a tabloid social news presence, and the least bankable name in New York real estate. Chapter 3. Appeasers. The fix was supposed to be in. Before a single primary vote had been cast, John Ellis Jeb Bush had locked up the Republican Party's big money, its top talent, and its senior leadership. As governor of Florida, Bush had cut taxes and balanced budgets. He had challenged unions and championed charter schools. He had won accolades from Karl Rove, the deepest thinker on our side, and Arthur Brooks, president of the American Enterprise Institute, a top-drawer intellect. On June 15, 2015, Bush bounded onto the stage at a Miami community college in an event carefully designed to showcase his leadership attributes, his newly trim physique, his policy knowledge, his fluency in Spanish, his deep hold on his must-win home state. That same day, he released a series of uplifting YouTube videos. Over swelling music, he hailed his record. We led. We reformed. We got results. He saw solutions where others saw only difficulties, a nation poised to advance into its greatest century yet. Within 7 weeks of that announcement, Jeb Bush's candidacy lay in smoldering wreckage. As of June 30, 2015, Jeb Bush had raised in excess of $120 million, almost all of it in big gifts from a tiny number of wealthy families. Seldom in the history of fundraising has so much bought so little so fleetingly. Between December 2014 and September 2015, the heir to the most successful brand in Republican politics plunged from first place in the Republican field to fifth. In desperation, the Jeb Bush campaign purchased 60% of all political spots aired in New Hampshire in the month of October 2015. That ad barrage pushed his poll numbers in the state from about 9% to about 8%. Donald Trump entered the presidential race the day after Jeb Bush did. He announced his candidacy in terms as grim and despairing as Bush's had been soaring and hopeful. "We got $18 trillion in debt. We got nothing but problems. We're dying. We're dying. We need money. We have losers. We have people that don't have it. We have people that are morally corrupt. We have people that are selling this country down the drain. The American dream is dead." Trump had no organization, no endorsements, no plan, and no money beyond whatever of his own he was willing to spend. Within 3 weeks, he had surged into first place in the Republican contest. There he stayed, except for an interval in November, when he was briefly overtaken by Dr. Ben Carson. From Jupiter Island, Florida, to Greenwich, Connecticut, from Dallas's Highland Park to Georgia's Sea Island, not to mention from a numberless horde of pundits and reporters, the cry arose, "What went wrong?" 3 years earlier, Republican elites had identified Jeb Bush as the exact solution to their party's problems. They had been stunned by Mitt Romney's defeat in 2012. Despite their shock, Republican donors, talkers, and officials rapidly converged on an explanation of the loss and a prescription for the future. Immigration. Everything else in the party message was working fine. A fiscal plan that ended the Medicare guarantee for people under the age of 55 to finance a big tax cut at the top. Repeal of the Affordable Care Act and its extension of health care to millions. No rethinking needed there at all. They attached all the blame instead to the one element of the Mitt Romney platform that the party's donors elected and leading ideologists had never much liked anyway. His gestures toward stricter immigration enforcement. Nobody expressed the party elite's consensus view more assuredly than the Fox News regular Charles Krauthammer. "Ignore the trimmers," Krauthammer wrote in his first post-election column. "There's no need for radical change. The other party thinks it owns the demographic future. Counter that in one stroke by fixing the Latino problem. Do not, however, abandon the party's philosophical anchor. No reinvention when none is needed." "We've got to get rid of the immigration issue altogether," Sean Hannity told his radio audience the day after the 2012 election. "It's simple for me to fix it. I think you control the border first. You create a pathway for those people that are here. You don't say, you gotta go home, and that is a position that I've evolved on." Fox News's principal owner agreed. "Must have sweeping, generous immigration reform," tweeted Rupert Murdoch on November 7th, 2012. "It would be inhumane to send those people back, to send 12 million people out of this country," the casino mogul and Republican donor Sheldon Adelson told the Wall Street Journal in December of that year. "We've got to find a way, find a route for those people to get legal citizenship." The Republican National Committee made it all official in a March 2013 post-election report signed by party eminences. The report generally avoided policy recommendations, with a notable exception. "We must embrace and champion comprehensive immigration reform." To advance the cause, Paul Singer, one of the most open-pocketed GOP donors, made a six-figure contribution to the National Immigration Forum that spring. Almost as soon as the new Congress convened in 2013, Senate Republicans worked to strike a deal over immigration issues. A bipartisan gang of eight, including Florida's ambitious young Senator Marco Rubio, agreed on a plan that would create a path to citizenship for millions of illegal immigrants and substantially increase legal immigration limits for both high and low-skilled workers. But otherwise, the post-2012 Republican elite yielded on nothing and doubled down on everything. No U-turns, no compromises. More passionately than any other Republican, Jeb Bush had celebrated the contributions of immigrants like his Mexican-born wife, Columba. Bush spoke Spanish at home. He had sought his fortune with Cuban-American business partners. He had converted to Roman Catholicism. His children proudly identified as Latino. Yet on every economic issue, no Republican adhered more strictly to party orthodoxy than Bush. What the party elite had somehow failed to notice, unfortunately for them, was that their voters did not share the donors' and pundits' policy consensus. While the party elite coalesced upon more immigration, less secure health coverage, and one more Bush, the rank and file were frantically signaling less immigration, better health coverage, and no more Bushes. The other candidates for president in 2016 also missed the signal. Trump alone perceived it. "When do we beat Mexico at the border?" he demanded in his June 16th announcement address. "They're laughing at us, at our stupidity, and now they are beating us economically. They are not our friend, believe me, but they're killing us economically. The U.S. has become a dumping ground for everybody else's problems. When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us, sick. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people." Trump's harsh language scandalized almost every pundit who commented on his words. But 3 weeks later, on July 5th, an illegal alien from Mexico, Juan Francisco Lopez Sanchez, gunned down Catherine Steinle, a young American woman on a San Francisco wharf. Lopez Sanchez discharged a stolen weapon. It's not clear that he was aiming at Steinle. Aimed or not, Lopez Sanchez's bullet struck the 32-year-old in the back and severed her aorta in front of her horrified father. She died in the hospital 2 hours later. It soon emerged that Lopez Sanchez, a repeat drug offender, had been ordered deported 5 times since 1993. He was at large that day in July because San Francisco's sanctuary city law forbade local police to notify federal authorities when they released him after his most recent detention. Within a week of the Steinle killing, Donald Trump skyrocketed into first place in the Republican field. Trump's language about immigration and the American future likewise failed to impress those who had done well in the Obama years, the coalition of the ascendant, as the National Journal's Ron Brownstein called it. Minorities, urbanites, new immigrants, knowledge workers, credentialed professionals, owners of capital assets. Yet Trump found an audience all the same. Polled in the fall of 2015, half of Trump's supporters within the GOP reported having stopped their education at or before high school graduation, according to the polling firm YouGov. Only 19% had a college or post-college degree. 38% earned less than $50,000. Only 11% earned more than $100,000. Trump Republicans were not ideologically militant. Just 13% described themselves as very conservative. 20% described themselves as moderate. Nor were they highly religious by Republican standards. What set them apart from other Republicans was their economic insecurity and their cultural anxiety. 63% of Trump's supporters wished to end birthright citizenship for the children of illegal immigrants born on U.S. soil. More than other Republicans, Trump's supporters distrusted Barack Obama as alien and dangerous. Only 21% acknowledged that Obama was born in the United States. 66% of Trump voters believed that Obama was a Muslim. Trump vowed not only to get tough on undeserving outsiders, but also, and this mattered every bit as much to his rise, to protect deserving citizens from other Republicans' designs on their pensions and benefits. We've got Social Security that's going to be destroyed if somebody like me doesn't bring money into the country. All these other people want to cut the hell out of it. I'm not going to cut it at all. I'm going to bring money in, and we're going to save it. Trump promised a campaign independent of the influences of money that had swayed so many Republican races of the past. I will tell you that our system is broken. I gave to many people. Before this, before 2 months ago, I was a businessman. I gave to everybody. When they call, I give. And you know what? When I need something from them 2 years later, 3 years later, I call them. They are there for me. And that's a broken system. He promised to protect the sons and daughters of farmers and factory workers from being drawn into another war in the Middle East. If we're going to have World War III, he told the Washington Post in October 2015, it's not going to be over Syria. As for the politicians threatening to shoot down the Russian jets flying missions in Syria, I won't even call them hawks. I call them the fools. In reply, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, and Ted Cruz, joined by Mitt Romney from the sidelines, attacked Trump as a con man, as a pathological liar, as a cheat and a swindler. Trump was blasted by outside groups as a traitor to Republican ideals and ideology. The premier conservative intellectual magazine, National Review, blazed the article Against Trump across its February 16, 2016 issue. For good measure, NR illustrated the feature with a cartoon of Trump as a strutting Mussolini. Sometimes you can't fix it, RNC Chair Priebus resignedly acknowledged in April 2016. Sometimes you can just take a 7-alarm fire and just make it a 4-alarm fire. It's still burning, but it's not as bad as it was. But everything was fine. I'm not pouring Baileys in my cereal. Half the contributors to National Review's Never Trump issue would ultimately make their peace with Trump's leadership. Some, such as Brent Bazell of the Media Research Center, reinvented themselves as his most vigorous defenders. Priebus would reach an accommodation of his own, culminating in his service as President Trump's first chief of staff. Yet as late as the Republican convention in Cleveland, most Republican office holders and donors still regarded Donald Trump warily. Speaker Paul Ryan's convention speech offered only the most glancing references to the party's nominee. The next time that there's a State of the Union address, you'll find me right there on the rostrum with Vice President Mike Pence and President Donald Trump. Only with Donald Trump and Mike Pence, Ryan added, do we have a chance at a better way. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell sounded barely more enthusiastic in his convention speech, omitting all personal praise of Trump and instead itemizing bills that President Obama had vetoed and that President Donald Trump would presumably sign. Big donors remained wary of Donald Trump through the election. The people who could write large checks had noticed Trump's practice of diverting campaign funds to his own businesses, $12.5 million altogether, according to a December 2016 CNN review. Trump waited until the last possible minute to write off the $50 million he had loaned his campaign, leaving many donors uncertain until midsummer whether their gifts would be used to elect a president or to reimburse Trump for his takeover of their party. The reluctance of big donors to invest money in any Trump enterprise explains how Hillary Clinton outraised Donald Trump almost 2-to-1 for presidential campaign dollars. The large majority of Trump's $335 million presidential campaign take, $280 million, was given in increments under $200. Trump's surprise win forced a hasty big money rethink. The convention in Cleveland may have been a pinched and listless affair, but Trump's 2017 inaugural committee was easily the best funded in history, bumped by large gifts from anti-Trump Republicans seeking to make amends. Paul Singer alone donated $1 million. He was rewarded with a White House visit in February 2017. Trump's inaugural committee collected $107 million, double the previous record of $53 million set in 2009. Inaugurations cost money, but the largest costs are paid by taxpayers. The ceremony on the Capitol grounds is funded by Congress. The parade along Pennsylvania Avenue is paid out of the military's budget. Security is covered by the federal government. So how was Trump's record-breaking $107 million inaugural hall actually used? Good question, and one to which few will ever learn the answer. Many inaugural donors voluntarily disclose their gifts, but there is no obligation upon the inaugural committee to disclose how funds are spent. Nor are there many legal restrictions on how such funds can be used. The inaugural committee could, for example, transfer millions of dollars to pro-Trump PACs without disclosing that fact to anybody. Or it could spend huge amounts at Trump's hotels and businesses. Or it could simply hoard the money for some future secret use. The Trump inaugural committee promised that any unused funds would be donated to charity. No charity ever announced receipt of any gift from this source, nor did Trump's inaugural committee offer any accounting for the money it received. The corporations or individuals who provided the $107 million surely had few illusions about what they were buying and why. $500,000 bought a seat at a dinner with the vice president and his wife. $1 million bought lunch with the new president, congressional leaders, and incoming cabinet secretaries. These donors hoped to buy access and goodwill, even protection from a thin-skinned and vindictive president. But by writing those checks, they also bought into the Trump financial system of pelf and predation. As did, one by one, the leading figures of the Republican Party, former presidential rivals, leaders of Congress, the party's governors, state legislatures, and state party organizations, the mighty fundraising networks of the Koch brothers and other formerly Trump-skeptical donors. With the rarest exceptions, all came to heel. Ohio governor and former Trump nomination rival John Kasich publicly disclosed that he had written in John McCain's name. Jeb Bush refrained from an endorsement, but his son George P. Bush reluctantly backed the ultimate Trump-headed ticket. In almost every other case, the toad was swallowed. Senator Ted Cruz epically unloaded on Donald Trump on May 3, 2016, the eve of the Indiana primary. This man is a pathological liar. He doesn't know the difference between truth and lies. In a pattern that is straight out of a psychology textbook, he accuses everyone of lying. Whatever lie he's telling at that minute, he believes it. The man is utterly amoral. Even at the Cleveland convention, Cruz declined to endorse his former rival. By election day, however, Cruz had submitted. He formally endorsed Trump on September 23rd. If Clinton wins, we know with 100% certainty that she would deliver on her left-wing promises with devastating results for our country. After the leak of the Access Hollywood video, some Republicans tried to leap off what they thought was a burning boat. Yet when Paul Ryan separated himself from Trump on October 11, 2016, it was Ryan's support, not Trump's, that cratered, dropping a net 28 points among Republicans in only 10 days. The institutional Republican Party therefore had no choice but to adhere to Trump, and Trump had no choice but to rely on it. Whereas Trump's presidential fundraising badly lagged behind Clinton's, the RNC and the other joint party committees kept pace with their Democratic counterparts. $543 million for the RNC and others versus $598 million for the DNC and its cognates. The RNC paid for Trump's field operations and much of his digital operation. The RNC and the Republican state parties took responsibility for get-out-the-vote operations. It was RNC data that powered Trump's most effective ad campaign, titled "Hillary Thinks African Americans Are Super Predators." The short animated video was directed via Facebook to infrequent black voters, not to win them from Trump, but to discourage them from going to the polls at all. Like Ted Cruz, Republicans overcame any distaste they felt for Trump by convincing themselves that a Hillary Clinton presidency represented an unthinkably catastrophic outcome. Every stance and principle that had seemed so important in the long run-up to 2016 was junked in order to avert the Clinton apocalypse. Entitlement reform? The party's post-2012 rethink of immigration? Judeo-Christian family values? All had to be set aside in the face of the extinction-level risk of a Clinton presidency. In the impassioned words of the radio host Mark Levin, a Trump opponent all through the primaries, "If you believe Hillary Clinton is virtually as off-her-rocker left-wing socialist as Senator Bernie Sanders, if you believe that Hillary Clinton is in part responsible for the rise of ISIS and what took care sick in Benghazi, how the hell could you take any steps, passively or affirmatively, that would put that woman in the Oval Office? As bad as the Republican may be, how could you stay home and allow that?" Of all the party institutions that yielded to Trump, far and away the most important was Fox News. Republicans used to think Fox News worked for us. Now we are discovering we work for Fox News. I first said that in 2010, and the observation held true for half a decade. Yet here, too, Trump changed the rules. He bent Fox News to his will, not the other way around. Fox did not begin the 2015-2016 cycle in the tank for Trump. The first Fox debate in August 2015 featured the network's least ideological anchors, Bret Baier, Megyn Kelly, and Chris Wallace. The trio posed tough questions to Trump. Baier took Trump to task for refusing to commit to supporting the ultimate nominee. Megyn Kelly challenged Trump on his long history of demeaning comments about women. Chris Wallace challenged him on his habit of hurling wild, uncorroborated charges. "Mr. Trump, it has not escaped anybody's notice that you say that the Mexican government is sending criminals, rapists, drug dealers across the border. Governor Bush has called those remarks, quote, extraordinarily ugly. I'd like you, you're right next to him, tell us, talk to him directly and say how you respond to that, and you have repeatedly said that you have evidence that the Mexican government is doing this, but you have evidence you have refused or declined to share. Why not use this first Republican presidential debate to share your proof with the American people?" It was Kelly's question, however, that most fiercely enraged Trump. "You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals." While Trump would respond to Wallace's question, which came later in the debate, with something approaching professionalism, to Kelly he retorted with a threat. "What I say is what I say, and honestly, Megan, if you don't like it, I'm sorry. I've been very nice to you, although I could probably maybe not be, based on the way you have treated me. But I wouldn't do that." Of course, Trump soon did do that. In an August 2015 telephone interview with CNN's Don Lemon, Trump complained of Kelly. "She gets out and she starts asking me all sorts of ridiculous questions. You could see there was blood coming out of her eyes, blood coming out of her wherever. In my opinion, she was off base. I just don't respect her as a journalist. I have no respect for her. I don't think she's very good. I think she's highly overrated." Trump then suggested that he would not join any more Fox debates if Megyn Kelly were involved. That threat to Fox News opened one of the most decisively successful of Trump's repeat campaigns for dominance over his perceived foes, especially women. The next Fox debate had been scheduled for January 28, 2016, on the eve of the New Hampshire primary. Trump demanded that Megyn Kelly be excluded from the panel of questioners. Fox issued a press release mocking Trump's presumption. We learned from a secret back channel that the Ayatollah and Putin both intend to treat Donald Trump unfairly when they meet with him if he becomes president. A nefarious source tells us that Trump has his own secret plan to replace the cabinet with his Twitter followers to see if he should even go to those meetings. Trump persisted. He complained about Kelly on Twitter and Instagram. In a CNN interview 3 days before the scheduled debate, he bluntly told Wolf Blitzer, "I don't like her. I don't think she's fair to me." Kelly, Trump said, had been a nobody before the first debate. She owed all her fame to him. He wanted to attend the debate and so warned Kelly, "She better be fair." But he concluded pessimistically, "I don't think she can treat me fairly. I'm not a big fan of hers. Maybe I know too much about her." Fox issued a second pro-Kelly statement. Sooner or later, Trump, even if he's president, is going to have to learn that he doesn't get to pick the journalists. We're very surprised he's willing to show that much fear about being questioned by Megyn Kelly. So Trump escalated. He announced a boycott of the Fox debate. Instead, he would engage in a fundraiser for the vets. That fundraiser resulted in the usual shaky outcome. It would take months for Trump to be shamed into disgorging the money he raised and to honor his own million-dollar pledge. Politically, though, the stunt more than delivered. The woman who was once acclaimed as the future of Fox News abruptly found herself condemned as the enemy within, a strumpet fascinated with sex in the accusation Newt Gingrich flung at her in an October 2016 interview. Trump's allies at the National Enquirer gathered the salacious gossip that would provide the tabloid with a cover story in May 2017. Megyn Kelly exposed secrets of her rapid rise to power from her ruthless early career to a plastic surgery makeover. In December 2016, Kelly disclosed that after Trump's August outburst against her, she had faced death threats serious enough that she had hired armed guards to protect her three young children, all then under the age of 7. Megyn Kelly would leave Fox in January 2017. After the election, Fox's coverage descended to new sub-basements of abjectness. Fox would replace Kelly with Tucker Carlson, who filled his hour with trolling and spoofing reminiscent of white nationalist message boards. The morning show Fox and Friends would dedicate itself to flattery of and therapy for the ego-needy president. Sean Hannity shifted to the prime 9 p.m. Eastern time slot after Bill O'Reilly's termination, lent credence to any story, no matter how wild, that might deflect attention from the Trump-Russia connection. Hannity reverentially interviewed Julian Assange and publicized the fantasy that WikiLeaks had received the Democratic emails not from Russian intelligence, as the CIA, FBI, NSA, and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence had assessed, but from a disgruntled DNC staffer, Seth Rich, who was subsequently murdered, most likely, it was heavily insinuated, at the behest of important people in the Democratic Party. Fox's on-air talent abased themselves to argue that even proven collusion by the Trump campaign with Russian intelligence would be, at worst, alarming and highly inappropriate. The steady flow of alternative facts from Fox News's hosts, to borrow the useful phrase of Trump's aide Kellyanne Conway, would impose serious costs on the network's business. In May 2017, Fox would fall to third place among cable networks for the most desired viewing audience in weekday prime time, adults aged 25 to 54. Fox remained the largest cable network overall, but its eyeballs increasingly lacked spending power, threatening its future profitability. While the core Fox audience watches to have its prejudices ratified, many occasional Fox viewers have become impatient with a news network that distorts, misrepresents, and oftentimes outright ignores the country's most exciting domestic news story. The predicament of Fox illustrates the larger crisis of conservatism in the Trump era. Gullibly or cynically, resentfully or opportunistically, for lack of better information or for lack of a better alternative, a great party has slowly united to elevate one man into a position of almost absolute power over itself. Many who submitted to Trump perceived perfectly clearly what they were submitting to. The big donors knew their money would be misappropriated. Congressional leaders foresaw that Trump would behave outrageously and erratically. Trump's apologists in the media world recognized his lack of principle. They decided in favor of him anyway, expecting, or at least pathetically hoping, that some larger good would come of it. The Republican rank and file, however, acted on emotion, not calculus. On the night of August 25, 2017, President Trump used the cover of Hurricane Harvey to pardon Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. In July, Arpaio had been convicted of criminal contempt of court for defying a 2011 order to cease traffic patrols that profiled Hispanic drivers in his Arizona county. Through the Obama years, conservatives had reinvented themselves as constitutionalists, upholders of law against arbitrary executive power. Ted Cruz even wrote the foreword to a book accusing the Obama administration of unprecedented lawlessness. But that was then. The Arpaio pardon generated paroxysms of enthusiasm in the conservative base. A popular columnist for the conservative site townhall.com tweeted to his 115,000 followers a pithy explanation of the justification for the about-face on arbitrary executive power. The main reason for President Trump to pardon Sheriff Joe was "fuck you, leftists. The new rules, bitches." Followed by a smiling, sunglasses-wearing emoji symbol. He made a cogent point, too. By August 2017, what was left of the philosophy formerly known as conservatism beyond "fuck you, leftists"? President Trump may not have had policy ideas in the conventional sense, but he had a sure grasp of the emotions that impelled the Republican voting base, and how those emotions could be manipulated to empower himself and enrich his family. In 1960, a quip circulated that the Kennedy family arrived in power like the Borgias descending on some respectable Italian town. The joke did not quite work because it did not quite apply. The Kennedys' many faults were joined to an undeniable grace and generosity of spirit, to authentic public service, and a large vision of America. Not so for the Trump family. They came to loot. If rules stood in their way, the rules could go smash. Chapter 4. Plunder. Not to injure anybody's national pride, but even before the Trump presidency, the United States ranked a not exactly reassuring 18th on Transparency International's Corruption Index, behind Hong Kong and Belgium. In modern times, however, governmental corruption in the United States has been a problem associated much more with states and localities than with the federal government, and within the federal government with Congress more than the executive branch. In response to the Watergate scandal, Americans amended their laws and raised their expectations. Newt Gingrich surrendered a quite legal book deal in 1994 because of public criticism that a multi-million-dollar advance to a newly elected Speaker of the House looked too much like a gift from a wealthy supporter. Former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle stepped away from his nomination as Secretary of Health and Human Services in 2009 because he had not paid taxes on the use of a car and driver in his business career in the mid-2000s. Candidates and presidents since Gerald Ford have followed the practice initiated by George Romney in 1968 and published their tax returns. Politicians accepted these new, stricter post-Watergate standards because they assumed everybody else accepted them. But what if somebody decided to reject them? What would happen then? Donald Trump guessed, nothing much. He not only declined to release his tax returns, but directed campaign funds to his own businesses. As late as January 2016, half a year after the launch of Trump's campaign for the Republican nomination, Trump's associates pursued a deal to license the Trump name for a Trump Tower Moscow. When the deal ran into difficulties, Trump's lawyer appealed for help to contacts high in the Putin regime. A rule of law state can withstand a certain amount of official corruption. What it cannot withstand is a culture of impunity. So long as officials believe that corruption will usually be detected, and if detected, then certainly punished, for just that long they will believe that corruption is wrong. It is for this reason that corrupt regimes swiftly evolve toward authoritarianism, and authoritarian regimes toward corruption. Outside of the Islamic world, the 21st century is not an era of ideology. The grand utopian visions of the 19th century have passed out of fashion. The nightmare totalitarian projects of the 20th have been overthrown or have disintegrated, leaving behind only outdated remnants, North Korea, Cuba. What is spreading today is repressive kleptocracy, led by rulers motivated by greed rather than by the deranged idealism of Hitler or Stalin or Mao. Such rulers rely less on terror and more on rule-twisting, the manipulation of information, and the co-option of elites. Their goal is self-enrichment. The corrosion of the rule of law is the necessary means. As a shrewd local observer explained to me on a visit to Hungary in early 2016, the main benefit of controlling a modern bureaucratic state is not the power to persecute the innocent. It is the power to protect the guilty. No president in history has burned more public money to sustain his personal lifestyle than Donald Trump. Three-quarters of the way through his first year in office, President Trump was on track to spend more on travel in 1 year of his presidency than Barack Obama in 8, even though Trump only rarely ventured west of the Mississippi or across any ocean. In May 2017, Congress appropriated an additional $120 million to provide security to the Trump family, half of it to reimburse local police in Palm Beach and New York City for the extra costs imposed by President Trump's weekend getaways and the decision by First Lady Melania Trump to maintain a separate residence in the first year of the Trump presidency. Even this record-breaking allowance soon proved inadequate. By August 2017, the Secret Service reported it had exhausted both its budget and its agents' human capacity for overtime work. Facing a wave of resignations and retirements, the Secret Service asked Congress to raise the cap on agents' pay and overtime from $160,000 to $187,000. Kevin Johnson reported in USA Today, "The president's jaunts to Mar-a-Lago are estimated to cost at least $3 million each, based on a General Accounting Office estimate for similar travel by former President Obama." The Secret Service has spent some $60,000 on golf cart rentals alone this year to protect Trump at both Mar-a-Lago and Bedminster. The annual Kushner family ski vacation in Aspen in March 2017 cost taxpayers at least $330,000. An Eric Trump business trip to Uruguay in early January 2017 cost the Secret Service nearly $100,000 just for hotel rooms. It cost tens of thousands more to accompany Donald Trump Jr. to Vancouver in March 2017 and to protect Tiffany Trump, the president's youngest daughter, on a German tour and Mediterranean yachting holiday in July. Costly as the Trump family was to the presidency was correspondingly lucrative to the Trump family. Jonathan O'Connell reported in the Washington Post in August 2017 that the Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C. collected $4.1 million more than projected in the first 4 months of that year. Foreign governments, U.S. corporations, and Trump's own super PAC made the Trump Hotel their first choice of venue. Earnings from food and drink exceeded expectations by more than 37%. Despite a low occupancy rate, only 42%, the hotel managed to extract an average room rate from the guests who did stay there of almost $660 versus an average of $495 at Washington's other ultra-luxury hotels. Party funds poured into Trump's personal pockets. The Republican National Committee, Trump's 2020 re-election effort, the Republican Governors Association, and other GOP campaigns and committees together spent about $1.3 million at Trump properties in the first half of 2017. Trump's Florida clubhouse, Mar-a-Lago, doubled its initiation fee to $200,000 in January 2017. Trump formed his 2020 re-election committee on his inauguration day. In its first 6 months of existence, the committee spent $600,000 of its donors' money at Trump-branded properties. The U.S. military spends $130,000 per month to lease space in Trump Tower, on the chance Trump might need communications equipment on a visit to his home. The arrangement is a sublet, however, so Trump may not receive any of the money personally. These petty grifts swelled the income and enhanced the lifestyle of a family that always needed more, and was never particular about where that more came from. And unlike the sad students at Trump University, whose fraud lawsuit was settled by the Trump Organization in March 2017 for $25 million, the U.S. government could bear the cost. Yet even $600,000 here, $4 million there, hardly amounted to big money by the standards of Trump family ambition or Trump family exigency. Donald Trump and his Kushner in-laws are perceived as fabulously wealthy, but while they do own substantial assets, they also owe enormous debts, and it has never been clear for either family how those two figures balance. Trump has teetered on the edge of ruin again and again through his career. Over the decade since the 2008 financial crisis, his son-in-law seems to have faced ruin on an even more epic scale. In 2007, Jared Kushner persuaded his family group to purchase an Eisenhower-era office building on New York's Fifth Avenue for a then-record-setting $1.8 billion, financed by $1.215 billion in commercial mortgage bonds. The deal almost instantly went catastrophically wrong. Occupancy dropped in the wake of the financial crisis of 2008. Rents collapsed. Things did not improve for the Kushners' 666 Fifth Avenue property during the recovery. The business locus of New York shifted west and south, away from Fifth Avenue and often out of Manhattan entirely. A post-2010 building boom offered potential tenants more attractive contemporary premises at competitive rents. The Kushner building lost $10 million in 2015 and was on track to lose considerably more in 2016. By November 2016, the situation was becoming truly desperate. The Kushner family had refinanced the building in 2011, promising to reinvent it as a glittering new condo tower, doubling its height and adding glamorous new retail space. This additional capital came with a tough time limit. The interest rate on the loan was scheduled to double to 6.35% in December 2016. Harsh new fees would come due as well. But in the interim, a miracle had occurred: the political rise of Donald Trump. The Kushner family very suddenly found itself attracting prospective financial partners from around the world, as Suzanne Craig, Joe Becker, and Jesse Drucker reported in the New York Times. On the night of November 16, 2016, a group of executives gathered in a private dining room of the restaurant La Cina at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in Midtown Manhattan. The table was laden with Chinese delicacies and $2,100 bottles of Chateau Lafite Rothschild. At one end sat Wu Zhaohui, the chairman of the Waldorf's owner, Anbang Insurance Group, a Chinese financial behemoth with estimated assets of $285 billion and an ownership structure shrouded in mystery. Close by sat Jared Kushner, a major New York real estate investor whose father-in-law, Donald J. Trump, had just been